as well. So I'm here throughout the weekend on your Easter weekend breakfast. Coming up at one on LBC, it's Ali Mirage, but just catching his breath coming down the stairs this morning, it's my good friend Matt Fry.
Paul, nice to see you. Thank you very much and happy Good Friday. We're going to be talking about Donald Trump, I'm afraid, yet again this morning. Some breaking news, actually. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, has said unless a minerals deal is signed with the Ukraine, then they're going to actually give up on the whole venture of some kind of ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine and possibly a lasting peace. So we'll keep an eye on that. But we're going to ask a more fundamental question. What on earth has happened to the United States 90 days or so after Donald Trump took over power? Everything has been turned upside down, everything everywhere all at once. How do we navigate that? And how do we navigate the trade war between China and the US? You may not be interested in that, but it is interested in you. So call me.
On your radio, on Global Player, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, Washington's most senior diplomat has warned the US is prepared to move on from Ukraine peace talks. Marco Rubio says he wants to establish within a matter of days whether or not progress can be achieved. He was speaking in Paris this morning after holding talks with his European counterparts.
This is happening on the continent of Europe, and so obviously European powers will care deeply about what happens, so they have a stake in this, and we recognize it. But in the end, I think we all want the same thing. I think from the U.S. perspective, we've spent 3 years, billions of dollars, supporting the Ukrainian side, but now we've reached a point where we have other things we have to focus on.
Separately, Ukraine says it's agreed the outline of a deal to give the U.S. access to its rare minerals, oil and gas. President Trump suggested his second state visit to the UK could take place in September. He told reporters in the Oval Office, it's an honour to be a friend of the King.
I have great respect for King Charles and the family, and I think they're setting a date for September. I don't know how it can be bigger than the last one. The last one, was, as you know, was incredible. It's a great honour to be so chosen.
Mr. Trump was given the invitation by Sir Keir Starmer on his trip to the White House in February. A no-fly zone has been imposed over the King's home at Sandringham in Norfolk. The restrictions were requested by the security services in the days after President Zelensky's visit to the estate in March. Several drones were reportedly spotted during the trip, triggering a security alert. Detectives have opened a murder investigation following the disappearance of a woman in Cardiff. Paria Vasey was last seen leaving work nearly a week ago. A 41-year-old man and 48-year-old woman are being questioned by police. Italian authorities have confirmed two British people were killed in a cable car crash near Naples. They were among four people who died when a cable snapped near the top of Mount Faeto yesterday. Another man remains in a critical condition. Millions of people could face disruption to their travel plans over the Easter weekend. Some baggage handlers at Gatwick are on strike and hundreds of rail engineering projects are taking place. LBC weather, cloudy with rain across the western half of the UK, brighter spells in eastern England and Scotland. A high of 17 Celsius. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
You know, it's easy to miss important things with all the notifications you get. Like this message from Sergey. Help me, I'm trapped in the upstairs bathroom. Delete. But this message from Otto Sergey is important.
Hello, Mr. Alexander. I've delivered your personalized car insurance deals ahead of your renewal.
Thank you, Otto Sergey. Simples. Just make it simples with personalized deals delivered by Otto Sergey from Compare the Market.
Help! Prices generated from information you provided. Review before purchasing.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Matt Fry.
Good morning to all of you. Donald Trump hasn't even been in office for 100 days, and he's set about changing the world and overturning our perceptions of what America stands for. That is happening on so many levels. Trade, security, rule of law, freedom of speech, freedom to learn. Trump has picked fights on so many levels, at home and abroad. His mood is mercurial. Will the monarch of Mar-a-Lago wake up with distemper or not? One day he escalates the trade war, the next he backs off. Nice Trump, nasty Trump. He might call it the art of the deal. The rest of the world calls it infuriating. to that point. Last night, he promised the Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, in the Oval Office that the EU would get a trade deal soon. He said much the same about the UK early in the week. Can we believe him? Where are the details? Then we heard that Ukraine and the US had signed a memorandum of understanding on a minerals deal, paving the way to end the war. The final version, which is apparently better than the one that looked like outright extortion, will satisfy both sides. But will it? In any case, it needs to be approved by the Ukrainian parliament. We'd love to know. We will aim to find out this morning. The world, according to Trump, is mercurial and volatile and capricious, but there are some constants. Trump seems to believe that might makes right, that smaller, weaker countries should submit to the will of stronger ones. Only that explains how he could state this week that Ukraine had started the war with Russia. This is blatantly absurd. It's also an insult. But in his universe, if a weaker entity doesn't submit, it is their fault for getting clobbered. The underdog becomes the predator. This is a fundamental reimagining of the American story, of the story that we adhere to. Resilience in the face of adversity, overcoming weakness, facing up to bullies, not giving them our last sandwich in the hope that they will leave us alone. The world, according to Trump, is divided into spheres of influence, fortresses, if you like, walled off, strong, mutually suspicious. Forget global supply chains. Forget free trade across the planet. Forget then the foundations of peace and prosperity that have allowed most of us, not all of us, but most of us, to thrive over the last 8 decades. In this Trumpian world, America is the king of the jungle, except there is another big beast to contend with, and that, of course, is China. China ain't backing down. China is fighting back. They see tariffs as a declaration of war of sorts. And while they don't welcome this moment, and while their economy has its own weaknesses, they are more prepared for the long slog than the United States. Now, you, dear listener, may not be interested in the American trade war with China, but it sure as hell is interested in you. My first guest this morning, then, is Michael Sheridan, author of The Red Emperor, Xi Jinping, His New China. He served also as the Far East correspondent for the Sunday Times for no fewer than 20 years. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Matt.
How has China prepared for this trade war?
Seriously, deeply, methodically, and calmly. It's the opposite style to what we've seen from the White House. And it speaks to the style difference between the two leaders. President Xi Jinping, who is also head of the party and head of the army, has barely spoken in public. He certainly doesn't go on social media, and he doesn't write things in capital letters. So the Chinese have played this very calmly and coolly. They have prepared a long time. They have a suite of responses. They have a toolbox to reach into, and they have already hit back with their own tariffs, measures to curb the export of rare earths, and other sanctions against American companies. So they are playing this seriously.
And they're playing it seriously, and they're playing it in a much more prepared way, because, of course, they were already hit by sanctions, first by the Trump administration in 2016, and then, of course, Biden continued many of those tariffs.
Well, it is worth remembering that this is a bipartisan approach in the United States. Both Republicans and Democrats agree that China is the competitor and the challenge. So there's agreement on that. And the Chinese know that it's serious, no matter who's in office. But what I would say is that they have had time to prepare. The Biden period was one of continuity. And under the new Trump administration, they may have absorbed a few shocks already because these numbers are prohibitive, but they are certainly not going to back down. It would be politically unthinkable. They may well compromise and make deals along the way, but Xi Jinping is a red emperor. He is not going to pick up the phone and call the real estate mogul in Washington. So there is a real mismatch here. And I suspect the cooler heads in Washington and indeed Beijing are hoping they find a way to climb down on both sides and just get talking at some point.
Well, there were hints in that direction, but only very, very small hints yesterday from Donald Trump. But of course, as I said earlier, we never know with these hints whether they actually become something slightly more substantial. Just tell us about the imbalances of trade, because the kind of orthodox calculation in Washington is that they, the Chinese, sell us much more stuff than we sell them. Therefore, they will suffer more in a trade war. But that's not strictly speaking true, is it?
Let's bear in mind the biggest cliche, which is that China is very, very, very big. Its GDP is enormous, and exports to the United States represent only about 15% of all its exports everywhere. So there's 85% of the Chinese export market that is not the United States. They have already reduced their dependence. They've diversified. Xi Jinping, even this week, was striding around like an emperor, visiting Vietnam and other countries in Southeast Asia. And he is spreading his wings over these countries who are looking for friends, who don't want to be punished by their allies. There's a great deal of uncertainty about the United States. And do remember, China is going to be there, and he will be poised to swoop and take any advantage, economic or political, that he can. So this is a stupid game from the American strategic point of view. And the Chinese have very smartly stepped into their place. Now, I'm not saying that the Chinese have the answers. I mean, nobody is queuing up to copy the Chinese political model. There are not hordes of immigrants bashing on the doors of China for its wonderful opportunities. So the Chinese offer is not actually that good. But if it's better than the American offer and the Western liberal trade order, countries will take it.
One of the misconceptions that was underpinned by what J.D. Vance had to say about Chinese peasants the other day, you know, is this sort of idea that they're very, you know, they can make Barbie dolls, you know, and they can screw things together, but basically they're not innovating. They're not coming up with the ideas. That is still America's remit. Again, that is fundamentally wrong, isn't it? Especially when you look at things like electric vehicles.
Oh, look, they've gone ahead of that rural, agricultural-based economy for a long time. By the way, J.D. Vance, among the other things he gets wrong, is that the word peasant is not a pejorative in China. Mm. Chairman Mao exalted the peasants along with the workers.
But perhaps he was paying them a compliment. We never know. You know.
He was. He was. And in fact, the Chinese official who's in charge of Hong Kong, more or less, has just said, well, the American peasants can now bow down to China because we are a proud nation and we're not giving in. But let's be serious for a second. China is going ahead so fast with artificial intelligence, new generations of chips, all the plans and projects for a new 21st century economy. I've read and studied Xi Jinping's latest statements and speeches. They're out there ad nauseam. All he talks about is new technology, new industry, conquering different new opportunities, taking China to a different stage, electric vehicles, artificial intelligence, the Chinese machine learning, artificial intelligence tool that has come up and surprised everybody. That's what they're focusing on. And they gave Western journalists a tour recently of a Huawei plant in eastern China that is like a technology campus that any Silicon Valley king would die for. Mm. They are charging ahead. They talk about the 21st century economy, the new economy. They are not talking about tariffs and borders and migration and sovereignty. These are to them, this is 19th century power concepts. Xi Jinping is interested in ruling the 21st century, not fighting the battles of the 19th. And that is the single big advantage that China has.
Mm. One of our colleagues described the new electric vehicles being made by Huawei, which is a mobile phone company, as mobile phones on wheels, essentially. This, you know, their cars, their self-driving cars and their electric vehicles are so interconnected with the rest of our digital ecosphere. It is quite astonishing. And we'll leave that to one side. I mean, what you've just said is kind of what I've suspected for a long time, is that Donald Trump is fighting over jobs that went, you know, kind of out of fashion in the middle of the last century, while that lot are preparing for this century. And I don't see America having a plan that deals with all the repercussions of this trade war, whether it's supply chains, where they get their rare earth metals from, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, look, J.D. Vance's book, Hillbilly Elegy, which is, by the way, a formidable piece of
it's wonderful. Yeah,
it's an excellent book, but it's about nostalgia. It's about evoking a past in America that has gone. And I don't know any serious global economist who thinks that hard metal bashing manufacturing is going to come back to Pennsylvania and Virginia from southern China. It's not going to happen. So the Chinese took advantage of the first wave of globalization from the late 80s onwards. They have regrouped. And they are poised to take advantage of the next stage of globalization. And that's exactly the kind of marketing that is going to demand high technology, electric vehicles, interconnectedness, all the things they are perfecting in China, not just for consumer confidence, but in order to control the population. So it's becoming digitally seamless in China, how people can live their lives but be governed at the same time and watched every step of the way. So there's political dangers here as well as economic ones.
Indeed. And I think, I mean, you know, ask me which society I'd rather live in, a chaotic America run by, you know, mad Donald Trump, or, you know, a much less chaotic police state run by Xi Jinping. I know which one I'd choose. But there are weaknesses in China as well, aren't there? There is a property bubble, you know, there's a debt crisis. Tell us about how much those weaknesses could derail, you know, the current project of China in the middle of this trade war.
Well, I have to say, I think I still would opt to live in America rather than Xi Jinping.
That's what I meant.
I saw quite enough of Xi Jinping's China. And remember, they have used technology to make the people the servants of the government, not the other way around. Yeah. What could go wrong? Their big things have been investment and property. You know, there's a large rural population in China. Many people wanted to go to the cities, own flats, have a home, go up the ladder of progress as their parents did. There's a property bubble. Prices have gone down in many areas. Things are stuck. There's over-leveraging. There's corruption on all sides. But I remember two things. One, the Chinese economy is so big that it can withstand most of these pressures domestically. And two, the government pulls the levers. Xi Jinping can do things that Donald Trump can only dream of. He can order the banks to issue loans. He can compel brokers to buy shares. The government can even set the price in the market if it so demands. And so you need to recall, and we've had this debate in Britain just this week over steel and other things, the Chinese state controlled the economy. Even if it doesn't run a company on paper, it does in practice if it wants to. The law compels entrepreneurs and businesses to submit to whatever the state wants. So they have many, many levers, and they have deep reserves. They are confident, rightly or wrongly, they are very confident that they can withstand this.
Finally and briefly, no one wins in a trade war. Protectionism is bad for everyone, but some people might, or some nations might, win a little bit more than others. In this standoff between China and the US, who are you putting your money on?
Long run, I'm putting my money on China because its economy is so diversified. It deals with, you know, more than 100 countries as key export markets. Its products are unbeatable because the supply chain and the logistics and the resources are there in a way that simply can't be replicated in the United States today. The trade war is an outdated concept, and what Trump should be doing is getting on with competing on the real frontiers of the next century, which are the ones we've talked about.
Michael Sheridan, author of The Red Emperor, Xi Jinping and His New China, thank you very much indeed. The question to you is, in this trade war, which you may not be interested in, but I'm assuring you it is interested in you, which side would you pick? Who do you think will prevail? How do we survive this? I mean, we're little old Britain, the island of floating towards the middle Atlantic. We don't have a gang at the moment. We're outside the EU. We are having a bit of a problem reimagining our so-called special relationship with the US. So how do we navigate this? 0345 6060 973. I'm Matt Fry. This is LBC. The time is now 10:16.
This is LBC.
Every minute matters when it comes to saving a life. Tom Swarbrick was joined by former referee Chris Foy to discuss why every football fan should know CPR.
Every year outside a hospital, 30,000 people suffer cardiac arrests and only 1 in 10 survive. So the more people we can get to learn and understand CPR can only be a good thing. Search the British Heart Foundation website. It's a 15-minute lesson in how to perform CPR.
Thanks to Sky Bet. Play responsibly. LBC. Easter offers end Monday in the Furniture Village sale. So freshen up your home for less with huge savings on sofas, dining, beds and bedroom furniture. And that's on top of sale prices. Up
for Zen Easter Monday at Furniture Village, Ideal Homes Retailer of the Year.
Complete your Easter feast with the perfect wine pairing from Waitrose. Get 25% off six or more bottles of wine or fizz over £6, including the fresh and floral La Gioiosa Asolo Prosecco.
Ooh, I'll have a glass of that.
Or even the classic zesty number one Chablis. And the always delicious, refreshing, citrusy and fruity Whispering Angel. Cheers to that. Waitrose. Selected stores and lines, subject to availability, exclude Scotland, boxed wines and bottles priced £100 and over.
Tonight's Euro Millions jackpot is £44 million.
Now that calls for a dance.
Well, if you insist.
Hit it! Dip me like you've never dipped before!
Get that Euro Millions feeling tonight. Euro Millions from the National Lottery. Play on app. Estimated jackpot. Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Matt Fry on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
We're talking about China, or China, as Donald Trump likes to say. It's an important subject. This is the most important bilateral relationship on the planet between the US and China, the two big economic superpowers on the planet, basically at loggerheads in the middle of a trade war that essentially has shut down trade between these two nations. That cannot be good for them and indeed also for us on this island. Tons of calls coming in on 0345 6060 973. Let's go to Sarah in Bootle. Sarah, you're on the air.
Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
Having watched what's going on in America since the inauguration, you can only look on and put your head in your hands with what Donald Trump's been up to, between inverting the narrative of what happened in Ukraine and bullying President Zelensky, shutting down on freedom of speech, ripping up the rule book when it comes to protected status for anybody from war-torn countries in the world, that are in America, such as Afghanistan and Haiti and wherever else. Throwing people out without any reason whatsoever.
Or a fake reason.
I mean, it couldn't get any worse.
Well, it's, as I said at the beginning, sort of everything everywhere all at once, right? So it's kind of difficult to know where to look. The man is in a hurry to change everything. And it's a little bit like throwing spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks. And so far, not an awful lot has stuck, but people are very upset.
Yeah, and the thing is, with this trade war, I mean, he has managed to upset the majority of the world. Basically, Donald Trump is an overgrown playground bully, and Xi Jinping is not, and President Xi is not all that far behind. Excuse me.
Are you okay?
Yeah, just a bit of a...
Take a swig of water, have a cappuccino.
It's all right.
Or a long latte.
Yeah,
we can make all the noises while you make it. We'll be patient.
Yeah, don't worry. The thing is, Donald Trump wants all the jobs back in America, as we said before. Unfortunately, the world doesn't work like that. And at the same time as him giving all these tariffs out to China, which are totally loony tunes, he's having a go at Canada, Mexico, the EU, all the small countries.
And islands populated by penguins. Yeah. And don't forget the penguin islands. Tariffs on penguins.
Oh, please. Okay. I believe the penguins were most upset. They said, excuse me, we do not export fish to you. We like to keep it for ourselves.
It makes a good meal. Sarah and Bootle, thank you very much indeed. I hope you have a wonderful Easter weekend. Let's go to Mike and Marlowe. Mike and Marlowe.
Yeah, good morning, Matt.
Hello.
How are you? Yeah, I just think that the association we're going to have with China is going to get stronger. And I don't buy anything American, do you, at the moment?
Well, I think if you look at the various products you use in your household, you know, there are probably quite a few American components in there, whether you like it or not. It's probably easier to identify stuff from China.
I've just bought some playing cards. They're Chinese made. I bought a couple of weeks ago an attachment for my Hoover. That's made in China.
Yeah, most of the stuff we make. There's that old saying, isn't there, that God made heaven and earth, and China made everything else. And that seems to be kind of true.
yeah. But I won't be buying American meat. I won't be buying chlorinated chicken. I won't be buying American cars. We're about to put some. We've got a board game that we're about to put into America. But the tricky bit is, how much is it going to cost? Mm.
Are you working for a company that makes board games? Are you working for a company that makes board games?
No, it's my company. It's my game. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Sorry. Okay. Fantastic. What's the board game?
It's called Ur. It's a word game.
All right. Okay.
So that Ur is the noise that you make in your brain when you're thinking.
I make that noise all the time. It's a deafening noise. I'm making it right now. So have you sold many of these games to America in the past?
We haven't. We're just about to do a Kickstarter campaign. Yeah. And then once we've done that, we will then know our numbers. You know, and then once you've got your numbers, you go to China and we'll do a split load. Some of it will come into London, in the Tilbury Docks, and some of it will go into Los Angeles. But we can't price it because we don't know what... tomorrow's going to bring, you know, this is the problem, and this is why the markets are failing.
Yeah, I can totally understand that. If you're trying to run a business with any sort of supply line, let alone building a factory to produce stuff, why on earth would you make that commitment if you don't know what the future, as in tomorrow or the day after, would actually look like?
Absolutely, yeah. But that's why the markets are failing so, and that's why everything's up in the air, because nobody knows what the, you know, what Trump's going to do next. Nobody's got a clue. What are we up to now? 145% tariff?
But you say, Mike, you don't want to buy American stuff. So let's, you know, take your average smartphone. You know, I've got an iPhone, which is owned, you know, is made by an American company in China.
Yes.
I'm assuming it was assembled in China, and it might have been assembled with components that came from Vietnam, Indonesia, perhaps even India, and then China.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
But it's plying profits into Apple, which is an American company.
Yep.
So it's tricky. I think in a globalized economy, it's very hard to extricate yourself from, you know, and to be, you know, to buy purely one nation or the other nation, because that's the whole point of the global supply chain. You can't pick it apart.
Absolutely. But I think people might be making conscious decisions now.
Yeah.
Whereas before they wouldn't, you know, an iPhone. So I've got an iPhone. I'm speaking on it now. But in the future, with Trump's antics as they are, I think people are going to make conscious decisions about whether it is linked to an American company, whether it is an American product.
Mm.
I think people will make that conscious decision.
Well, happening already. I mean, look at, you know, Tesla sales are down 54% in China. They are down, which, by the way, I think Shanghai has the biggest Tesla factory in the world, producing 1 million of these cars every year. That'll be interesting as a conflict of interest. And then in Europe, sales of Tesla are down almost 50%. Then you've got European tourists deciding not to go to the US. That must hurt as well. Anyway, listen, there's lots to talk about and very good points. Mike and Marlo, thanks so much. Let's go to Kieran and Cork. We only have guests on this morning where the first letter of their name is an alliteration with the place they're coming from. Okay, Kieran and Cork.
I'm K, but you're close.
I know. We're talking about sounds and not actual letters. So it's,
K and C.
Don't be a stickler. Don't be a stickler details.
Sorry.
Come on. Don't spoil my one joke of the morning.
All right, okay.
And now launch forth on the airwaves with your point, please.
All right, thank you. Basically, I think it's kind of, there's a weird serendipity in that the two nations that kicked off the free market 40 years ago, nearly to the day, are now the ones isolating themselves from the whole thing and pulling back. And they were basically in control of the free market. Do you know what I mean? So Thatcher and Reagan kicked this off, and now the UK and the US are totally isolating themselves from it, which is kind of ironic in some kind of weird way.
Yeah, it is ironic. So what's your recipe for getting through this?
Well, I mean, I'm not British, I'm not English, but the Irish have skin in the game.
I bumped into your Taoiseach, into your Tornister at a hotel in Washington just a few days ago. He was there to kiss a few rings and make a few deals, and I think he came away with a smile.
100%. I mean, and the UK and Irish economy are interlinked in lots of ways, and there's Northern Ireland and a whole lot. But I think the way forward is the UK inevitably has to rejoin the European Union and inevitably then enter into negotiations with the Chinese that the European Union are already engaged in, really. To be honest, that's what's going to happen, I think.
I think you're right. Kieran and Cork, thank you very much. Let's go to Tony in Tolworth. Yes, we have a TT combination. My goodness. Tony and Tolworth, you're on the air.
Matt, I'm going to just say to you that I recently took my son
over to Asia. I've been going there for 31 years. Never had a problem, never had an issue with anybody in Asia in 31 years. So I took my son over there. He was born in Asia, and for the first year of his life, he spent it over there. I've looked after him for the last 19 years in the UK. He's got a British passport, and he understands the work ethic of people in the UK. I took him over there for the last month. We got caught in the earthquake. We're on the ninth floor of the hotel. That wobbled. We nearly died, but that's another issue.
Wow.
My point, that's right. We was in Chiang Mai on the ninth floor. Yeah. We just arrived in the hotel. Anyway, my point was, on the way back on the plane, we flew back to the UK, and we come from a certain place over to Beijing, and we spent 5 hours sat on the flight with a young lady who worked for a big corporation in China. Got talking to her, and after quite some time, she started to open up about China and what she was doing. She was on a program, a 7-day program, which she'd been doing since 2021, 2022, 2023, 2024. She goes over for 7 days at a time. And what she does is she controls the social media. Every word, every letter that's put out on social media of this particular boy band that China manufactured. This big corporation that one of your guys earlier said that the state has a hand in what the corporations do. I believe that.
Because I think it's absolutely right. I mean, listen, China is very good at making high-speed trains and electric vehicles. And, you know, it's incredibly good at manufacturing. But, you know, the minute you write something that criticizes Xi Jinping, that'll be the last thing you write on the internet. So it is a police state. I think, you know, they will deny that officially, but we all know that to be true. And so I guess the kind of freedom that we're used to comes with a certain price. And that price is messiness.
She was put into that position to steer this boy band. Mm. This is the foreign countries that China use to export all their goods through, like Vietnam, like Thailand, all the countries that surround Asia. What the government does of China, through what this conversation with me and this girl was able to pick up on, is that this program of manufacturing a boy band for this Asian country with five Chinese members and two Thai members was her instruction on the program from the corporation to go over and steer and manage and make sure this boy band does really well, is really successful for the local people. Mm. And that in turn helps their government say, look, China's brought success to us. Yeah. We will let them use us and work with us for import and export. So when the guy talks about 15% of trade being to the US from China and China not being too bothered, Donald Trump's smarter than a lot of people give him credit for. By putting these tariffs on the other countries, stops China from using all these other countries through Asia that they're sweetening with deals like boy bands and manufacturing boy bands for them. It's a bit of a bigger picture. But I sat there next to my son and he said, Jesus, the government would go to that extent to create boy bands in another country in Asia to sweeten them, to allow trade to... I said, listen, it's
well, there we
machine.
Go. You met the Simon Cowell of China. Well, there we go. That's something. That's news to Simon, that there's another version of him like that. Tony and Tobles, interesting story. Thanks very much. And keep them coming, there's calls. Trade war between China and US. Where do you stand on this? How do you navigate it? How do you survive it? 0345-6060973. But before we go on, we've got lots of subjects to get through this morning. Let's go straight to the news headlines here on LBC at 10:31 with Thomas Watts.
The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has warned the US won't try to broker peace in Ukraine for weeks and months on end. He says there needs to be signs of progress within days because Washington has other priorities. President Trump's hinted he'll be heading to the UK for a second state visit in September. He was handed the King's invitation by Keir Starmer on his trip to the White House earlier this year. Italian police have confirmed two British people were among four tourists killed in a cable car crash yesterday. Four people died when the cable snapped at the top of Mount Faeto, south of Naples. LBC weather, cloudy with rain across the western half of the UK, brighter spells in eastern England and Scotland, a high of 17 degrees.
This is LBC.
Global Player is home to fantastic podcasts like Theatre of Crime.
I'm Pearl Mackey, and this is Theatre of Crime. Join me as I dive into court transcripts, police records, and newspaper archives to decipher the truth behind this forgotten tale of sex, lies, and horror. Together, we'll examine the murder mystery that had Britain in its thrall.
Global Player. Download it now for free.
I'm making a robot head with an Amazon box. I've painted it silver, and Daddy helped me make...
At Amazon, we're actually using paper bags for more of our deliveries.
And now, I'm making a paper hot air balloon. And I even made a little brown basket, and I'm making a dog that looks just like Monty.
Just one of the ways we've reduced the weight of our packaging by more than 40% since 2015, which is still good for playtime.
Mom, where's the scissors?
To learn more, visit aboutamazon.co.uk/sustainability.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With one-touch switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Credit of up to £100 to cover leaving fees. Visit vodafone.co.uk/broadband to find out about the switch process and for terms.
Forks at the ready. This Easter, Lidl won't be beaten on price. On our luscious leg of lamb from £6.15 per kilo. Or XXL juicy joint of British beef from £5.65 per kilo. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price.
On sale from April 14th and price match in most major UK supermarkets until the 19th. Lidl.co.uk/spendless while stocks last.
Matt Fry on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker now. Just say, play LBC.
It really is not an exaggeration when we say that everyone everywhere has to kind of readjust what they say, what campaigns are engaged in as a result of what's happening in the United States. And one of those people is, of course, Nigel Farage. You know, formerly, perhaps still, best friends with Donald Trump, but also someone who was very close to Elon Musk and then suddenly wasn't when Elon Musk said that Nigel Farage wasn't fit to run Reform UK because he distanced himself from Tony Robinson, etc., etc. So there are lots of issues here, and as I said, everyone has to make adjustments, has to rearrange the furniture. Now, Reform UK are in a bit of a, you know, pickle at the moment. They've got this feud going on with Rupert Lowe, one of their MPs, who is now suing Nigel Farage for defamation. And at the same time, of course, you've got the council elections coming up on the 1st of May and the by-election in Rumcombe and Helsby. This was a by-election caused when Mike Amesbury, the Labour MP, was convicted for basically thumping a constituent, which is never a good idea, especially when it's going to be filmed and it's out on the open street. So what are the challenges faced by Nigel Farage? What are the challenges for Reform UK? No one better to talk about this than Michael Quick, political journalist and author of One Party After Another, The Disruptive Life of Nigel Farage. Michael, disruption is something that Nigel Farage is very good at, but not as good as Donald Trump.
No, not as good as Donald Trump, and not as good at the moment as Rupert Lowe.
Yes. So,
and I mean, actually, if anything, Farage is trying to, bring about a bit of calm within his party.
Yes.
And sort of trying to distance himself from Trump. And I'm sure that in elections to come, I don't know if it's happened in these elections, opponents will be using lots of pictures of Farage and Trump under the golden arch and all of that. They're heading for a very good set of results.
What are the opinion polls? What are the latest polls indicating?
Well, most of the polls this year have had Reform ahead of the two other parties. Mm. I mean, which is pretty remarkable. Roughly 26%. So I mean, you there are so many players in the game, and they are actually fighting more seats than any of the other parties, which is unusual. Farage parties are generally very bad at getting candidates to fight local elections, but here's an exception. And there are a few mayoral races, notably the one in Lincolnshire, where Reform seem to be the favourites. So it looks like a good set of results, despite Farage's close association, or not as close perhaps as it was, with Donald Trump. So, that problem doesn't seem to have affected the polling, and nor so far does his feud really with his
his battle with Rupert Lowe. And it's not just involving Farage. I mean, Rupert Lowe is now suing Lee Anderson, the party's chief whip, one of the other MPs, and the chairman of the party, Zia Yusuf. So it's set to be, if it gets to court, and most live elections, it has to be said, are settled out of court, it's set to be a huge drama.
Does any of that drama benefit Nigel Farage and Reform UK?
Well, it does in a way, because I think Farage is obviously on the one hand trying to appeal to traditional Labour voters, but he's also trying to appeal to traditional Conservative voters. And if he can show that he is a firm nationalist politician and Brexiteer and all of that, but he is not an extremist a la Tommy Robinson. Mm. And by the way, I think you said Tony Robinson.
Did I say Tony? I meant Tommy. Sorry.
But maybe I misheard you.
No. You didn't miss him. It's just that, you know, it's early. It's early on a Friday. Good Friday morning. I've just come down from Leeds on the train. I'm amazed I made it, actually, because there was an animal on the tracks and we had to stop for quite some time. So that...
Well, yeah, that happened to me a few weeks ago. And I only got back at 2 o'clock this morning.
Oh, did you? Well, I've got no excuse at all then.
You're just... I was watching United last night.
Well, there you go.
But... where were we? Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. You were explaining. Okay, you were, God, it's like two old men sitting in the pub after too many drinks, and it's only 10:30 in the morning. You were trying to explain how this might benefit Nigel Farage.
Because it's basically able to show that there are more extreme politicians than him around.
Yeah.
And the crucial political difference between him and Lowe, apart from all personal stuff, is that Lowe believes in mass deportations of illegal migrants, a million or something like that. And Farage argues that's just utterly unrealistic. And he also knows that it would cause such a huge rumpus if that were to be attempted. And I think he would think a policy like that would deter more moderate, I shouldn't use the word moderate, more centrist. Conservative types from defecting to Reform. So if he can show that there are people well to the right of him who are around and are operating on their own or in other parties, that actually strengthens him in his way. And Farage is always very proud of the fact that way back around about 2010, 15 years ago, he saw off the BNP. And in doing so, again, it had the same effect, that he could show that I am the reasonable figure of British national, a reasonable British nationalist, and Eurosceptic, and all these people to my right are extremists, and you don't want them, and I'm different from them. So it's actually this battle is quite useful from Rupert Lowe's point of view. I would urge caution upon him. Politicians often get involved in libel actions and don't do well out of it. I mean, we remember the cases of Andrew Mitchell and Neil Hamilton, who lost hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds in
or millions, I think, in one case. Lost. Yeah, absolutely.
And worse than that, there are three politicians I can think of: Geoffrey Archer, Jonathan Aitken, and Tommy Sheridan, who went to jail. Having committed perjury in by-elections, it's a thing that politicians get up to. Now, I'm not suggesting for one moment that Rupert Lowe has committed perjury, but libel actions, you're going into the unknown. All sorts of things can happen. All sorts of stuff can come out, especially if it goes to court.
You're just giving him some very kindly financial advice because you don't want him to miss any meals, especially behind bars or anything like that. So getting to the wider political picture, I mean, what seems so clever about Reform UK, you know, whether by design or by default, is that both Tories and Labour are equally scared of them. And, you know, we had Kemi Badenoch trying to do a deal with them over the local elections the other day, and Nigel Farage said rather haughtily, thank you, but no thank you. And you've got the Labour Party that, whenever you mention the subject of Reform UK, their lower lip quivers uncontrollably. So who should be more scared of them?
I think the Conservatives, actually, because the Conservatives can be pushed into third place, whereas I think the Labour are more resilient. They've got more, they start with 410 MPs or however many it is at the moment, and they're in government. And Labour are, clearly becoming a lot more concerned about working class. Their traditional old base, which they've rather ignored in the years of Tony Blair and others, And, you know, the Scunthorpe story last week was not just about national security and not just about the economy, but it was about reminding people that we do care about working class northern people as well. And, of course, that's what Farage is going for right now, particularly in Runcorn, but elsewhere as well. And he's spent a lot of time in recent days up in the north of England. And, of course, that's the territory, and also the Midlands and other areas as well, of course. But that is the territory that he harvested so well in the 2016 referendum and in other elections where he's been moderately successful. And that was a total change from the early days of UKIP, way back 30 years ago, where it was very much a middle class, you know, colonels in golf clubs, home counties party, and people, you know, retired people along the south coast. That was the old UKIP that Farage was originally in. And it's transformed over the years. And of course, the parties have changed, and there's a new party and everything. Yeah. But he is, the focus is much more on the Labour's heartlands. And of course, there were, I can't remember the precise figures, there were about 100 seats where Reform came second in the general election. And nearly all of those are Labour seats.
Yes. I think it was 93 was the number, which is a very high number. And that, in part, you know, that explains why they're so nervous, the Labour Party, about Reform.
Yeah. And indeed, Morgan McSweeney is very clearly very, very aware of this. And the chief of staff to Keir Starmer, that some people say even more powerful than Keir Starmer. Mm. And I mean, in a way, I think some strategists in Labour would not mind a bit of a defeat in Runcorn, because it might wake the party up a little bit more to the threat posed by Reform. And remember, the first by-election, I think it was, of Starmer's reign was, and exactly 4 years ago, was Hartlepool, which Labour lost, a Labour seat they lost. And Starmer very nearly resigned over that. But it shook the party up. And this might have the same effect. If they lose not just the Runcorn by-election, but perhaps some of the mayoral races and some of the county councils that are being fought on May the 1st.
One of the criticisms, or actually at that stage it was still advice rather than criticism, that Elon Musk levelled against Reform UK and Nigel Farage, is what, you know, they weren't very good at, you know, organising the machinery of elections, of fielding enough candidates. Has that changed? I mean, did they take that on board? Are they now much better at, you know, at just organising the nuts and bolts of how to win an election with enough candidates that don't end up being, you know, unmasked as racists or whatever?
Yeah, well, certainly so far it's changed in that they found candidates for virtually every seat in local elections, which none of Farage's parties have managed to do in the past. But the interesting thing will be the quality of those candidates, because what's happened before with local government elections is that they've been in the UKIP days, they were elected to the council, and then you find that they had some extreme views that they'd expressed on Twitter or social media somewhere, and it was huge embarrassment to the party. And then some of these people who were elected to council in the UKIP days never turned up, and they didn't fulfil their duties, and that was hugely embarrassing. So whether the party can organise that much, we'll wait to see. But I think they're much more aware of the need for an infrastructure at the local level. For that, they need money. In the old days, they used to divert lots of European money, the sort of, in just the same way that Marine Le Pen has been convicted of, by the way, and all the parties in this country do it. And anybody who doesn't think that is either a fool or lying, but of course, European money from the European Parliament, and you know the place was awash with it. You know Europe better than me. That is no longer available to British parties, of course. So they've got to get money. They've got to set up local branches, local full-time agents, all of that. On the other hand, if the movement is strong enough, you can actually win elections in this country without a local organisation, as Ken Livingstone showed way back when he won the mayoral race for London as an independent. Hmm.
Just finally and briefly, when you talk to people from Reform UK and they imagine, you know, a rosy future around the next general election, which I know is a long time off, what number of MPs, you know, at the bottom end, you know, realistic cold shower, top end warm bath of optimism, what number of members of parliament would they think, you know, amounts to, I don't know, a historical turning point?
Well, I mean, anything above 100 would be remarkable. But above 100, they're probably not going to be. Well, they might be. It may well be. Depends what the Conservatives do. Yeah. I mean, more likely is that you have to have a Conservative UKIP coalition or working arrangement, a bit like the Conservative Lib Dem one that there was
That is quite possible, isn't it? That's a real possibility.
That's a real possibility. And you could see Farage as Deputy Prime Minister. Although they get more seats than the Conservatives, then he would be in line to be Prime Minister. And that's, you know, that's not, I'd say there must be a 20% chance of that. I think overall, Labour, and I think Labour have recovered in many ways since Christmas with the with both, you know, really the election of Trump has sort of galvanised Labour and other things as well. But I think Labour must be the favourites to win the next election. And crikey, it's a long way off. We're talking about 4 years away. Anything can happen in that time. But certainly, this is an extraordinary moment. And we in this country, it's interesting, the virtually the whole of the rest of the Western world, the traditional parties have been in huge decline or have died out. You know, across most of the traditional parties in Western Europe have died out or they're tiny now. The same in America, certainly on the Republican side. Whereas in this country, our two main traditional historic parties are both still in business, Labour thriving, the Conservatives, you know, in trouble, but certainly not dead. And whereas now Farage and Reform and his friends pose a huge threat to that.
The only point I would make there is that the CDU, you know, has come back from the almost dead to, you know, to run the next German government, whereas the SPD is in a lot of trouble, but it's also still in government. And of course, you've still got Republicans and Democrats, although the Republican Party looks remarkably different to the one of Abraham Lincoln, let alone George W. Bush, you know, so.
Indeed. And the other, I mean, the other great thing is that politics is so incredibly volatile.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about losing this by-election. In the old days, you know, governments didn't lose. I mean, do you know, there's a remarkable fact. Between 1945 and 1957, the governing party in this country, first of all Labour for 6 years and then the Conservatives, did not lose a single by-election. In the last parliament, I think the Conservatives lost 15, and Labour will probably get on for losing a similar number. And there, you get huge swings in opinion these days.
And it makes our job more interesting, Michael. It keeps us in business. You know, that's good.
Yes,
that's one of the few good things about it. We love a little bit of instability.
Current events may not be good for trade, but they're certainly good for our trade.
They are indeed. Michael Crick, author of One Party After Another, The Disruptive Life of Nigel Farage. And you can get a list of all the candidates in the by-election and, of course, in the local elections on the website. We're just going to quickly mention the Lincolnshire, Greater Lincolnshire mayoral election. Candidate Sally Horscroft for the Green Party, Andrea Jenkins for Reform UK, Marianne Overton, she's an independent, Jason Stockwood, Labour Party, Rob Waltham, Conservatives, Trevor Young, Lib Dems. There we go. I'm Matt Fry. This is LBC. The time is a glorious 10:49.
LBC.
At Wix, save on Dulux Standard 2.5-litre coloured emulsion. Was £22, now £15. Shop now and feel as proud as a peacock with Wix. Terms apply.
Huh. Have you ever wondered what a sandwich sounds like? Not much to it, is there? Unless, of course, it's a Walker's sandwich. Mmm, that is good. Now that's what a sarnie should sound like. Go all crisp in with Walker's. Delicious.
How much has your business changed over the past year? Arrange a free consultation at barnesroof.com. Barnes Roof, clever accountants for business.
Risk lurks unseen in workplaces, but with the right safety gear, you're ready. Arco, chance nothing. Find out more at arco.co.uk.
Lotto's big Easter bank holiday jackpot isn't just any jackpot. It's big. Like big, big. Like sorry. £15 million must be won this Saturday. Lotto from the National Lottery. Play on app. Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
This Easter at Lidl, we won't be beaten on price on our Pick of the Week veg. That's 2 kilograms of potatoes, a bag of parsnips, green beans or carrots, a swede, a bunch of spring onions, all from just 8p. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price.
Subject to availability. Selected stores. GB only. See lidl.co.uk/spendless for details.
Discover your Kia EV in our award-winning electric range. Explore the compact SUV, the EV3, UK Car of the Year 2025. Experience the sporty crossover, the EV6. Or drive in comfort with the 7-seater SUV, the EV9, last year's UK Car of the Year. Order by the 30th of June to get 3.9% APR representative across our electric range. Search Discover your Kia EV.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
T's and C's apply. Kia Finance.
Ali, how are ya?
Who's up for busting a move?
Fly from London to Spain from just £21.99 one way. Spend less than you thought on flights and more on the fun stuff, like kite surfing lessons. Grab some air. Fly low cost from the UK to over 80 incredible destinations, including Malaga. Book now at wizzair.com. Conditions apply.
Matt Fry on LBC. Text 84850.
Well, we're flying around the globe on this Easter Good Friday, and let's head to the Korean Peninsula. Now, North Korea has threatened retaliation against US bombers flying over South Korea in military exercises. The US and South Korea have flown their warplanes in a show of strength against North Korea's rapidly advancing nuclear programs and the threats that come with that. South Korea's defense ministry said that the US long-range B-1B bombers participated in the joint aerial drills aimed at strengthening the allies' combined operational capability and to demonstrate their deterrence capability against North Korea's advancing nuclear program. Now, remember, when Trump was president the first time, there was a massive song and dance about Rocket Man, as he called Kim Jong-un. Then there was a summit, I think it was in Singapore, where the two, you know, had a photo opportunity. Trump then, in his kind of first pitch, if you like, for the Nobel Peace Prize, how is that going so far, Donald Trump, said that only he was able to bring the North Koreans to the negotiating table. And then as soon as the photo op was over and the pictures faded somewhat, so did any hopes of a lasting settlement. And basically, North Korea is now stronger than it was at the time. We need to put this in context, because when everything happens everywhere all at once, as it does under Donald Trump, even things that we're taking our eye off, like the Korean Peninsula, can suddenly go, you know, they can blow up in our face, and we don't want that to happen. No one better to talk about this than John Nielsen Wright. He's head of the Japan and Korea's program at the Center for Geopolitics at the University of Cambridge. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
So, I mean, there's a lot of saber-rattling that goes on over the Korean Peninsula between North and South, but also involving the Americans. Is this more serious?
I think we should take it very seriously, in the sense that Kim Jong-un is a leader who is emboldened. He's emboldened by his closer relationship with Russia. The deal sending some region, somewhere in the region of 14,000 North Korean troops to fight alongside the Russians in Kursk, possibly expanding that to include perhaps actually North Korean troops fighting inside Ukraine, is a measure, I think, of just how strong that new bilateral military cooperation is. Last year, there was an agreement in June strengthening cooperation between the two countries. There's talk of a railroad connection being developed in the Russian Far East with North Korea. We know that the North Koreans, for example, are receiving missile defense capabilities from the Russians. And we know that Kim Jong-un is really focused on developing his military hardware and, of course, his nuclear capabilities. He's made that clear. He's made it clear also that he's willing to push the envelope in terms of challenging South Korea. Just a few years ago, the North Koreans tore up the understanding that unification was part of its diplomatic strategy with the South. That's no longer there. And in all of this, as you rightly point out, you know, the Trump presidency is, of course, concentrating minds in Pyongyang. One of the interesting questions is whether this sort of bravado from Pyongyang is an attempt to get Donald Trump to take them seriously.
What's also fascinating is that if Donald Trump sees the world divided into hemispheres controlled by, you know, big, powerful men like himself, Xi Jinping in Asia, you know, who knows what's going to happen in Europe, you know, between the EU and Russia, with Ukraine in the middle. If he sees the world in that way, does North Korea think this is an opportunity to basically do something with South Korea? Because at the end of the day, Donald Trump might not care. Is that why they're sending those troops to the front line in the Russian war with Ukraine? Because they think they can get away with it. Because I think under the last administration, they might have got a much more robust telling off.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the North Koreans are thinking that a deal with South Korea is really on the cards.
Donald Trump withdraws eventually his some sort of security guarantee in the way that he is threatened to do with Europe. Sorry, that's
yes, and I think that has to be taken really seriously. The South Koreans are certainly worried about this.
Yeah.
And for Donald Trump, of course, the big issue in Asia is China. Mm. So might he be prepared to do a deal with Kim Jong-un to moderate his commitment to the South Korean defense in return for strengthening his flexibility, for example, in dealing with Taiwan, in dealing with China? And actually maybe even sending a signal to the Chinese that he's going to boost his defense cooperation to deal with the threat from Beijing. The art of the deal, of course, is something that Trump has talked about. And of course, those previous meetings with Kim Jong-un suggested that, for example, in Singapore, when he came out of those negotiations, he said very explicitly, why do we need so many troops on the Korean Peninsula? He's also talked as a candidate in the run-up to the last presidential election about his close relationship with Kim Jong-un. But I think at the moment, Kim is so emboldened that he's not really about to sit down with Donald Trump. It makes much more sense for him to strengthen his ties with Russia, but also with China. Because China, of course, provides material assistance, economic assistance. We know the North Koreans, they've just held the Pyongyang Olympics for the first time in 6 years. They're looking at cracking open the door to more tourism that might include from China as well as from Russia and potentially also from other countries. And Kim, of course, needs economic progress. He's committed himself to a five-year plan that will come, if you like, to fruition, the end of that, in about a year's time. He needs to demonstrate to his own people that he's delivering on that front. So while he's militarily strong, economically, he needs more tangible results, if you like. For that, I think he needs to strengthen his cooperation with his authoritarian partners, first and foremost.
I mean, from experience, the North Koreans are quite good at throwing their toys out of the pram and doing something dramatic to be part of the conversation. They hate being, like everyone else, they hate being ignored, they hate being overlooked. Is there a danger that they might do something along those lines, or do they actually think that the tectonic plates are moving so much potentially in their direction, they're just going to unusually keep quiet this time, or relatively quiet?
I think we need to take that risk of a low-level provocation very seriously. We just saw in the last week or so, North Korean troops crossing the military demarcation line in the DMZ. That was really unexpected. The big worry is in the Western Sea, the Yellow Sea, the area around the so-called northern limit line. The maritime demarcation line between the two Koreas is not officially agreed between the two sides. Back in 2010, we saw the sinking of a South Korean frigate with a loss of 46 sailors. There have been previous provocations. The acting president of South Korea, President Han Duck-soo, a few weeks ago, warned about the risk of a potential provocation there. And it may be that Kim Jong-un, who is a relatively young man and a bit of a risk taker, might feel that it's in his interest to push the envelope and perhaps engage in actions to cross that line, as the South Koreans define it, in ways that might provoke a response. And here we are, of course, in the middle of an election.